Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio for Pre Liberties Current Affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Radio for Pre Liberties media manager here in Washington, D.C. With sounds of fighting, clashes between rival groups opposing protests, the curfew, and finally reports about security forces getting involved as we speak, we are seeing chaotic scenes coming out of Kyrgyzstan. In the meantime, government was dismissed and President Jeenbekov is out of public eyes for days. It's unclear who is who in the country and where things are headed as head-spinning developments are taking place. Of course, all is happening in the context of tainted election last weekend in which pro-government parties have allegedly swiped the election and opposition parties took the streets saying that was a rigged process. Now, we are here to discuss what's happening in Kyrgyzstan as we speak, how we got here, what's the likely scenarios going forward, and most importantly, how we can get out of this situation. To discuss all this, I'm joined by Dr. Asel Dolat-Keldiba, Associate Research Fellow at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek, Dr. Sania Toktogaziba, the constitutional law expert, also based in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, Dr. Eugene Husky, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the Stetson University, Florida, who has been working on Kyrgyzstani politics since the end of 1980s, and he has authored a book about his memories of studying Kyrgyzstan. And also Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us on this very important discussion. So things are changing in Kyrgyzstan every day, even every hour. So I don't know how we can really assess the situation as the developments are head spinning. But anyway, let's start with you, Dr. Asel. You are in Bishkek, and then we will follow up with Dr. Sania. So what's happening as we speak, Asel?
Well, it's difficult to say with precision what's happening in terms of all this political negotiations, right? Because all these negotiations within the parliament, they're still ongoing, incumbent parliament on one hand, and then the negotiations among the outside political parties who participated in the elections and who now constitute the opposition to Jeenbekov, they are all happening in an informal way. They're not public, and it's very extremely difficult for the society to figure out where is the balance of power currently. When Jeenbekov says that he's ready to step down, is it true or it's just a tactic to prolong time? We don't know that. When opposition political parties struggle to unify under one single candidate, we don't know what's the reason behind. Is it because neither of the candidates really respond to the criteria of cleanness, of reputation, of legitimacy, or is it because they cannot divide the power among themselves? So all this important, really, talks and negotiations which are happening on different levels, really happening in a secretive way. And that's why it's so difficult to figure out where is the balance of power currently, right? But what we know for sure is that today was a big day, so to speak, because today the main camps, the main camps were crystallizing. So for the moment we have three different camps. This is the group of Sadir Japarov, the illegitimately proclaimed prime minister, who's most likely, I mean, there is a lot of suspicion that he is actually already co-opted by Jeenbekov, by Matraimov, and he's unifying with the organized crime. So this would be the one group. The second group today, we saw the unification of four opposition parties, which include Birbol, Respublika, Atamekan, and Reforma, who then proposed their own candidate for prime minister, which is Babanov. And the third group, which was initially Atambayev and his entourage, but then later during the afternoon, Atambayev merged with Babanov. And they are today coming as a tandem. So while they were presenting this tandem on the main square, the Japarov's people behind the main square on the other old, what we call in Russian, the other old square, they began clashes.
Okay, so Jabarov's camp started clashing against the Babanov and Atambayev camp.
Yes, so the both sides have mobilized young people on their sides. The difference is that Japarov have organized young people who are very kind of militarily inspired, very, very aggressively behaving, and also including some organized crime, the criminals, what we in Russian call sportsmeny. the sportsmen, right? These specially trained young people. So they started clashing with the crowd, which was gathering around Babanov and Atambayev's tandem. And so some people are already injured, and there were already also actually an attempt to kill, at least that's how now Atambayev, Babanov, and Saparisakov are claiming, that there was somebody, at least there was a picture of a person who is directing a gun towards the car where Atambayev, Babanov, and Saparisakov were apparently driving out from that main square. We know that they are in safety, but this kind of turn that this political struggle now has transformed and morphed into the street violence, the street fights. This is something that we were afraid of, yet still thinking that it would be a possibility a few days ago. Mm-hmm. So our worst expectations, our worst concerns have realized today. That's why I said that this is a big day after the, it's a culmination basically of the struggle between different camps.
How serious is this fighting? Because we hear a bodyguard of someone being injured, like former Prime Minister Sariyev. Then there was a attack on this young candidate, Toktogaziyev.
Yes, Toktogaziyev. Yeah.
So how widespread is this? How serious is this fighting, clashes?
I mean, it's quite serious because, of course, when the political struggle takes such a violent form, it means that there is no return, for at least for Japarov. And it's very also strategically not very smart of him because he now showed to everyone, even to his own supporters, how violent he can be, how violent his man can be. Yet the tricky thing is that he his lawyer already announced that these were not his men, that these were provocateurs. And you know, in the era of fake news, politicians are very skillfully manipulating the fake news. So, of course, Japarov was already using all these fake accounts on social media to create hype around him or to actually create hype against the opposition leaders. And now he's going to turn the criticism into a fake news. Yeah, this were provocateurs and not him,
okay.
You know?
Okay, so...
And this, of course, is going to escalate further.
Okay, so let's bring in Dr. Sanya. Anything to add into what Asel has said in terms of what is going on at the moment in Bishkek? And also, it's very interesting to see, at least, you know, we are looking into this from 10,000 feet above, me personally sitting in Washington, D.C. So all these seems to be happening in Bishkek. Anything else happening outside of Bishkek?
Like, I would like to discuss this issue from the perspective of law, not like political science, because it is important. I mean, all these days, all the lawyers have been proposing specific solutions of this crisis, but no one was listening to us. And I will explain, like, what are those solutions. Essentially, the main reasons of these events was the presence of massive vote buying and use of administrative resources during the elections. And of course, the fact that the president Jeenbekov and his regime has been covering the corrupted clan Matraimov plus the elements of organized crime group throughout his entire like presidential election term. And of course, the results of the elections completely escalated the situation. And when this thing happened in the morning after they took the White House, there were like two choices before the opposition parties were actually made. It is whether they're going to go according to the 2010 scenario by establishing an interim government and ruling by decrees, which in a way is called like rule of exception, or to find a way out by rule of law or constitutional and legal means. I think the best way here would be to go according through the constitutional legal ways. Why? Because political context this time is completely different than in 2010. In 2010, all these groups who were part of the interim government, they worked together as a team. They had one united goal, and it was possible, actually, to rule by interim government and as a rule of exception. But this year, we have completely different dispersed the opposition groups. There was no unity amongst them. And if they have chosen the, let's say, the 2010 scenario, I think the situation could have been even worse, and there would have been no way out of it. Mm-hmm. So that's why, like, from the first day, all the lawyers were insisting that there we need to go back to the constitutional law solution of this problem, meaning that there should be a demand from the parliament to have their urgent meeting and calling and completely form the new government. And requesting the president to resign voluntarily. But both president and parliament were enacting deliberately. And whatever has happened today is fully their fault, because there is no legitimacy. There is no basically trust on both of these governmental bodies on the side of the people. But legally, they still are bound by the constitution and norms. They're still responsible. President is the commander-in-chief, parliament is the main representative body. And whatever they have been doing these days, total inaction, deliberate ignorance of the situation, have escalated it. And I think this full responsibility is on them. They were supposed to do that. So, and all these days we've been also suggesting that the main thing that we need to concentrate on was, if the parliament is not resuming their work, de facto we can consider that they have self-dissolved, which means then the government, sitting government, remains, and the Central Election Commission, without the approval of parliament and president, can call for a new re-election. So the most important thing is actually letting the executive branch to function, letting the, say, these forces and other defense forces to function. But that was the main problem.
Sunny, I'm just saying, like, you know, the today's news, I guess, is President Jeenbekov dismissed the government. So in theory, parliament is still there, the parliament. Thank you, Sunny. So, Bruce, let me bring you in here. Earlier, Asal spoke about this, the camps that are forming around various figures, Jabarov, Atambayev, and Babanov, etc. So what are leading to these formations? What sort of interests or ideologies are bringing them together? It's kind of very interesting the way this is happening, because until recently, those figures were in the opposing sides of the political spectrum, especially talking about Atambayev and Babanov. And Jabarov was recently in jail until he was freed by protesters this week. And now he's apparently with the camp that is aligned with President Jeenbekov. So you know what I mean. So bizarre developments are taking place. Of course, until this podcast is aired, they might be in the opposing camps again. But as we speak, tell us about how these camps are forming up and how these alliances are emerging.
Well, you know, in the case of the opposition parties, that one, I mean, they're natural allies, at least for the moment. You know, remember there was two separate coordination councils that they had formed, and they were all comprised of, like, opposition parties. There was some overlap there, too, and it was never very clear how serious they were, since I haven't really heard anything from either one of those today. But you know, that one was kind of a no-brainer, because they were all against the results of the election and the pro-government parties. You know, so like I said, they were natural allies, and so they formed these coordination councils. You know, again, they haven't really seemed to do anything since they did that. Jabarov's group, this is, I think, one of the worst elements of what's going on, is a lot of the people that you see there are convicts. They should be in jail, and Jabarov is one of them. All these people got let loose onto the street, you know, during overnight on October 5th and 6th when they stormed the Parliament building. You know, they've managed to rally their supporters back to them, you know, and I mean, look at what happened today. Effectively, you had one faction of one guy who was in prison, you know, Sadir Japarov, and the faction of another guy who was in prison, former President Atambayev, you know, engaged in fighting and shooting on the street, right? So, you know, I mean, this is, you know, like I said, it's too bad. If those elements hadn't been released onto society again, it might have worked out different. Now, as far as the, you know, the Atambayev Babanov thing is really strange, and that just seemed to have happened, you know, today during the march too. These two guys were not friends. You know, this is clearly an alliance of convenience, because if you remember before the 2017 presidential election, Atambayev had used administrative resources to, you know, do in defeat Babanov, and in fact the there was charges against him for supposedly inciting inter-ethnic hatred, and Babanov ended up having to flee because of all the things that Atambayev did. Atambayev later, when he fell out with Jeenbekov, recanted and said that Babanov wasn't a bad guy, and he had held to his word not to call for violence after the elections, and, you know, all those kind of things. But a little bit late to be saying that, since he had fled the country by that time. So So this, to see the two of them together, it was almost comical. You had to figure they really had nothing in common at all.
But they are agreeing on Babanov being a prime minister, is it? I mean, is it, that's what I heard from Asel, right?
Yeah, well, you know, if you're Almazbek Atambayev, you've been illegally freed from prison, and you could, and when this calms down, you probably go right back. So backing somebody to be prime minister is probably just watching out for yourself at that point. You can turn to him later and say, hey, I did you a favor, you know, and got my camp behind you guys, behind you when you needed support, so don't throw me back in prison.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. Okay, so there are so many camps here, so many figures. Some of them are together just because they need, as you said, they need each other for the moment. It's really not an alliance. So as chaos continues, camps are being formed, former prisoners, and in fact, convicts are walking hand in hand or leading this or the other camps. Though the government was dismissed today, but I guess President Jean Bekov must have some rule and the parliament still remain a legitimate body. But I was just wondering, who are emerging to be the leaders, to be the influencers out of this chaos? Earlier, we were also talking about youth groups who were really leading this entire uprising against the election results. Any thought on anyone who could bring camps together? Any unifying figures among the warring parties, so to call?
Right now, it's very difficult to say because, I mean, for me, the big question is whether the crowd that Sadir Japarov is gathering, where they are, as we call them, sponsored by him, they are paid by him, or whether they are genuine supporters, right? As far as for this unified Babanov and Atambayev tandem, at least before the merge between Babanov and Atambayev, one could say that the protesters that were coming to support them were genuine, because they support the parties inside this tandem, the Reforma, Birbol, Atamikin, and those supporters, one could say that they are more genuine because they believe in the changes. They want to support the young leaders. Dr. Gaziev is the representative of this generational change, right? And but now, kind of the merge of Babanov and Atambayev basically, put down a lot of people, including myself, because I don't believe even a minute this tandem being democratic or fulfilling the promise to hold democratic elections, right? And so it's very difficult to say whether this tandem has any legitimacy in the eyes of a larger public, of the larger society, or this is just a convenience because today people are saying, okay, we don't believe these guys, we don't really trust them because they betrayed our trust in the past, but currently the physical security is more important. Because only these people can face the organized crime. Because organized crime is the real power today.
Right.
It's scary and it's very disappointing at a time because it means that, again, we have to choose between evils, right? We're not supporting Babanov and Atambayev because they're great people, great leaders. No, we're supporting them because these are essentially the only politicians who can perhaps, probably, bring down the criminals and bring down the corruption. But the time will show whether they can... they might bring down the criminals, but will they bring down the corruption? That's an entirely different question.
Right. So, Dr. Husky, and you are also following Kyrgyzstan, the way things are developing. So, President Jean Bekov still being a legitimate president of the country, how do you read the role he's playing now? He's apparently in hiding. We see his videos emerging occasionally. So, what role he's playing? And what's your assessment of his future?
Well, Jean Bekov, it seems to me, is still playing the role of the mystery man in Kyrgyzstani politics. I mean, the one thing he has done decisively is to get rid of Atambayev's people and to end up getting Atambayev in jail. But he has been something of a cipher. He's been a very diffident leader. He's not been engaged. And he continues that, not just in office prior to the election, but now in the post-election period. And so one would have thought that he might have made himself more public, may have made more pronouncements, tried to rally his forces. He doesn't seem to have done that. And in fact, if we go back and look at the campaign period, one of the unusual features of this campaign is that the president, for the first time, refused to support a political party or parties. Not only did he not push a party of power, power, like Olga Kyrgyzstan or Akjol or the Social Democrats, but he said he was going to stand above the fray, which I think he did by and large. One of the reasons I think he did that is because he worried about what has happened over the last week happening and him becoming a lightning rod and a target for the crowds. He tried to inoculate himself against this kind of revolution, against a president, by staying out of the fray. Now, it obviously didn't work. But one of the questions I'd like to ask is, why did people come out on the street? I mean, the answer that has been given by many is that, well, the election was flawed. And we know that elections serve as triggering devices for revolts. But actually, compared to earlier Kyrgyzstani elections, I would say this is one of the least flawed. You didn't have the same scale of administrative resources used as you did in 2017 or earlier. So, you know, I'm just wondering why people came out in large numbers. I think one reason was the blatantness of the vote buying. It wasn't so much the scale of the flaws. It was that it was in your face and people could see the videos on the street. I think, you know, obviously that triggered the crowd. A population, of course, that was already frustrated by corruption, as Assel and others have said, by the virus, by a tanking economy. But we also have to ask ourselves, would this all have happened without the mobilization by various elites of what Assel called the sportsmeni, of these sort of semi-militia groups, that's a little bit overstated, to push the interest of these elite groups? You know, and I think we have to ask very seriously whether this was a genuine popular revolt.
Assel, you specialize in social mobility, and the question professor is asking, very legitimate one. So why? Why we are seeing what we are seeing?
I mean, I already talked to Eugen about this, and we decided to disagree on this, right, Jean?
Yeah. Yes,
I like this agreement to be on display on the Majlis podcast. Let's see.
I just really disagree, actually, with what Eugen said, with all respect, because you would ask any citizen in Kyrgyzstan, and of course they would tell that the president has orchestrated at least two political parties. One is Birimdik, that's his party, and the second one is Kyrgyzstan, that already existed before, but they went to the elections in order to support Birimdik in their coalition, to make together the coalition in the parliament.
But if he was such an important figure, if he was so active, why didn't he simply create a single party? In fact, there were three parties. If he was really deeply and immediately and directly involved, why doesn't he simply create a pro-presidential party?
Well, Birimdik is a pro-presidential party.
No, why have three? Why not simply have one?
Well, the second one, this Mekenim Kyrgyzstan, it's not his party. Yeah, it belongs to Raim Matraimov. And it's an independent party which has their own goals and objectives and resources. But the goal, I think, was to bring them to the power so that these three can create a coalition with a comfortable balance of power. And I think the question of why he didn't kind of create this large, massive party like in the past, the Alga Kyrgyzstan or the Akjol, because I think actually it doesn't really look great in the eyes of the international community on the one hand, and it doesn't really kind of suit the parliamentary system, because the parliamentary system presupposes variety and pluralism inside the parliament, which they would fake, because they would bring into parliament some 5-6 parties, and this would answer the requirements of both international community, which is, I mean, this is important for Kyrgyzstan, because Kyrgyzstan received a lot of funds for these reforms, and the second of all, to fake basically the pluralism. And they would still rule the coalition in the parliament, because these three are together.
Okay, very, very interesting. I think I need to take a very short break here. So when we come back, we will be talking about where things are headed going forward. So what are some of the likely scenarios in which Kyrgyzstan could come out of this crisis? So let's continue the conversation talking about these and many other questions very shortly. first, let me recap the debate. Today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Asal Dulut Kaldiba, Associate Research Fellow at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek, Dr. Sania Toktugaziba, the constitutional law expert, also based in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, and Dr. Eugene Husky, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Stetson University, Florida, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the ongoing political developments in Kyrgyzstan. So before we discuss some of the historical aspects of the current developments, as I promised, I will get back to it. I asked this question earlier, and let me start with that again. These developments are happening mainly in Bishkek, and earlier we have seen some protests, some people coming together in Osh, but why it is centered only in Bishkek?
That's a very interesting question. What's going on in the regions, and in particular in Osh, in the south? Because both Matraimov's family and Jane Bekov's family are originating from the south, Karasu and Osh, right? Personally, I expected some destabilization in that part of the country, that Jane Bekov's and Matraimov's would try to mobilize their supporters from their strongholds and use this card of a north-south divide. This is not happening for the moment, but I think if in Bishkek the contestation between now two camps, the Babanov-Atambayev's and Japarov camps, if this is going to escalate, I think the South is going to be also mobilized for this purpose. And the recent return of the former mayor of Osh, the notorious nationalist politician Mirzakhmatov, is very alarming because he has a controversial reputation under the Bakiyev regime and his participation in the interethnic clash of 2010 between the Uzbek and the Kyrgyz is very controversial as well. And his return, upon his return in the, at the airport in Osh, he was received and acclaimed and cheered by a large group of people, young men, who were standing there as a basically as an army, ready to receive the further orders. And Mirzakhmatov behaves himself also in such a way. He was telling this crowd that they should be tuned, always close to their phones, and at any moment they receive an order for him to be ready to go against Bishkek. Now nobody knows what these words mean exactly, to go against Bishkek, but there are a lot of people, in current actors in Bishkek. Does it mean that he supports Chinbekov or Matraimov? Because at the same time, he criticizes Matraimov as a corrupt people. So it's very unclear who Mirzakhmatov will be playing with and against. So I'm still expecting something to happen in the south, and I hope I'm wrong.
What about the other regions? Like in Osh's case, who's the mayor or the governor now? I mean, the guy who just has returned, or who's really running the day-to-day business there?
Yeah, that's a funny thing. Of course, there is no official resignation yet from the official mayor of Osh. Yet Mirzakhmatov was already holding his meetings with Matraimov's brother and with Asylbek Jeenbekov, the president's brother, at the office of mayor. So he already occupied his office, although he said that he is not the mayor himself, he's not occupying any official position, that he's just a citizen. But as a citizen, he widened his holding these meetings at the office mayor.
Very interesting. So what the security forces are doing, where they find themselves in this situation? Earlier, there was a, I guess, either rumor or the picture circulating on the internet, President Jeenbekov meeting the army chief. Where are they in this situation? Maybe, Sania, you want to take this question? What role they are playing?
I think the security forces and police officers, they're completely demoralized. Essentially, this is again because of the fact that right after these events took place, what we have experienced is this massive self-appointments. And again, there was like an urgent need to come back to this legal issues in order to settle this dispute, but it never happened. So throughout these days, entirely like Bishkek, local citizens have, we call them like druzhinas, the volunteers have literally been going outside and protecting our cities from looting and etc. So in a way, they are completely demoralized. And it is understandable because that night it was literally like nonstop clash between the law enforcement officials and the citizens. Another interesting thing is that there was all these days attempts from the organized crime groups to actually take control over the National Committee of the National Defense, National Security, Agukenbe, and then the prosecutor's office. So there was like this constant attempts actually to take over them as well. And now we had the secretary of the Security Council, Suvan Aliyev, going to the GKNB and claiming that he has the control over that. So essentially now a majority of the things would depend on who would be in control. So legally, Jeenbekov still remains the basically commander-in-chief. And according to the law and constitution, they have to obey his orders. So today, the state of emergency has been issued. And of course, now another legal question of can he do it without the approval of parliament or not. So the lawyers are also divided on this issue. So essentially, if this will be imposed, then the security forces on the rest, they would have no choice but to follow the and obey the orders of president.
So is that being
I think
followed?
There is an update. I'm sorry, I think there is an important update. I saw that Suvan Aliyev, who was the new head of the Security Council, and Kursan Asanov, who was acting minister of police, they were ousted just
today,
few hours ago. And they say that it was the internal decision of the officers to oust them.
Then who's now, in charge now?
Exactly. So in charge now, the deputy heads, the deputy ministers, who, of course, respond directly to Jeenbekov. So this is another important detail, because it means if all the law enforcement bodies now on the side of Jeenbekov's, their organized crime is on the side of Matraimov. Matraimov's on the side of the Jeenbekov's. We have basically a power on the side of Jeenbekov's and company. And this makes, of course, the struggle even more intense and even more critical.
So in which way, you have seen Asel, President Jeenbekov, exercising this power? I mean, are the forces listening to him? I mean, it's supposed to be emergency now. Is it really imposed?
I'm not sure about whether the emergency is necessary. I mean, the opinions are being divided.
Yeah, but...
On the one hand...
But it is there, right? I mean, it's in effect at the moment as we speak, isn't it?
No, not yet. It's going to be into effect tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow.
Once the parliament decides on this question in the morning.
Okay. So, Bruce, let's look into this from a wider perspective. Earlier, I think the Russian FSB director, I think yesterday or before yesterday, he had a telephone conversation with Suvan Aliyev. Now, Asel just said he's being ousted. So what the region is doing about this situation?
Oh, well, you know, I thought that was one of the most interesting developments of the day. Was for the first time, you know, Kyrgyzstan's gone through some complicated period since 2005. And I don't ever remember the four other Central Asian presidents ever releasing a joint statement, which they did today. You know, it was very safe and even-handed. They just kind of said Kyrgyzstan's part of our region. You know, the things that happened there affect everybody. You know, so it was. But just the fact that all four of them got together and released a joint statement was very curious. You know, in the past, in the previous two elections revolutions and the interethnic violence, you know, they all took their own stand on it. I mean, the reactions came in individually at different times to what was going on. So clearly they're taking this more seriously, or I don't know, perhaps just that the level of cooperation is much better between them since Karimov is no longer president of Uzbekistan. That's probably likely.
Professor Hosky, is there anything you would like to add into the regional reaction so far?
I want to return to an issue that was brought up by Asel about the North-South question, which I think certainly was very critical in 2005 and 2010. And while there's still the potential for real problems, if you remove a southern president and you have a predominantly northern leadership in the next few months, I think it's quite different today because of the way the two major parties whose roots are in the South, Birim Dik and Mekanim Kyrgyzstan, have put together their party list. They've actually done a good job of trying to integrate elites across the country. And if you look at the results from the election on last Sunday, you see that they did very well, actually, in Isikul and other in Chui and other parts of the north. And so what worries me a bit is that if we move towards new elections in a couple of months, which is the idea, if we can get there, and for some reason those two parties are prevented from running, I think it's going to be very, very difficult. I think then you are going to get a reaction from the South that would be quite serious. If they are allowed to contest the next election, then what prevents them from repeating the results? Perhaps, yes, you'll have reduced vote buying, but it's very interesting to think about what the next result is going to be of the election. Mm-hmm. A major question that the parliament is going to have to answer in the next few weeks is whether or not they're going to change the threshold in the proportional system from 7% down to, some have suggested 3, 4, 5 would be more reasonable. 7 is extremely high. And that was actually brought down from a 9% level that they had in the interim between 2015 and 2018. One of the problems that I see is that in the election, there was inability of the elites to engage in political learning. They created 13 different so-called opposition parties with a threshold of 7%. That was a disaster waiting to happen, and only one party got through, and then barely. So it wasn't just the elite, it was the voters themselves, in a way, who, of course, not only to some extent took some of the bribes, but also decided we're not going to plump our votes on one or two or three parties. We're going to distribute them across 13 parties, which allows the big parties, which had more money to begin with, to do so well in the election. So I think the real question about institutional design changes is going to be on the table in the next few weeks.
Okay, so talking about the next, earlier Asal was talking about, as people are negotiating, trying to negotiate with each other, what they are talking about, Asal, as to the future looking, what the future holds for this country and how we are going to get out of this situation?
That's a $1 million question, if only I knew.
I mean, at least in terms of what they are talking about. I mean, is there anything on the agenda about the future? What are the steps that they are thinking of taking going forward?
So from what I understand, those opposition parties which are now united behind the tandem, Babanov and Atambayev, what they want to do is, in case they manage to shift the balance of power to their side, it means that whether the parliament will choose Babanov as the prime minister and to form the government and to announce the new election. In that case, this group, they seek to change the electoral legislation. As Eugene already mentioned, these are very important changes, the lowering of the threshold. So what is very important to sideline the three political parties, Birimdik, Mekinim Kyrgyzstan, and Kyrgyzstan, from elections, banning them from participation in the elections. Because these three were the ones who were using their vote buying, their administrative resource, intimidation, and all those things which led to the falsification of the results.
But isn't there a recipe for another crisis to sidelining these three political?
Of course, because I think then we would see really their regions probably destabilizing as well. We don't really know what's going to be next now, whether Jeenbekov will manage to withhold his power to force the parliament to stick with Japarov. We don't know. This becomes a speculation, basically. The new day will show how the things develop.
Sanya, what's your thought? I mean, what people are talking about, what the political forces are talking about, what do you think is the most likely scenarios that we expect to see happen in Kyrgyzstan?
Unfortunately, the worst thing that we were expecting happened today. And as I have already mentioned, that it's fully on the blame is on the parliament and the president, that they haven't done their job properly. But from now, I mean, before that, we've been really hoping that there would be a possibility to bring it back and according to the law, they can form. Now, frankly speaking, if we don't basically escalate it, and try to settle it domestically, then there might be certain interventions outside. Maybe some interventions from Russia or the United Nations have offered that they can also help us to mediate and etc. But the typical recipe of the United Nations is through the unity government. And we know from Middle East and other cases that this might not as well work out. I really hope that we will be able to get out of this crisis ourselves without involving the international figures. But frankly speaking, after today, I just have no idea how we are going to get out of it, because all the parties, it seems like they're not planning to give up their ambitions and try to settle this dispute according to the law. And again, I want to highlight that currently, both the president and parliament is fully violating their duties and obligations under the constitution and laws, and they all should be brought later into responsibility for the crisis that is happening now in Kyrgyzstan.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm listening, I'm also getting news from Kyrgyzstan. The new development is that tomorrow, which is Saturday, October 10, MPs will gather at the presidential residence outside of Bishkek to discuss state of emergency and vote for a new prime minister. I don't have enough information here. I mean, we are talking about the MPs of the current parliament, right?
Yes. Yes, so official there still remain as the legal group. So then the question is, who are the main candidates? Like, is Babanov still running? And with Sadr Japarov, let's say, today, see, as the Supreme Court informed that they have actually, the decision was not that they have completely annulled, that he has been acquitted. So which means it puts under a big question, because according to the law, any candidate to become a prime minister who's convicted, he cannot run for the prime minister. And all these conditions according to which they were able to get the resolution of the Supreme Court is also under a big question mark. And I have no idea how they're going to still go with this scenario.
Also, in terms of party affiliation, this parliament was kind of very much in confusion. Like, there were people from Atambayev's party, and then they switched sides. And then where they stand in terms of the party affiliation, the current parliament, Bruce? In case if they indeed go and vote for a new prime minister, who is the likely candidate might end up becoming prime minister, given the party affiliation as it stands in the current parliament?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'd rather speak a little bit about the parliament, the composition of parliament itself. I mean, as you noted, a lot of these deputies are from at least the Social Democratic Party of Kyrgyzstan, and got in. There's different factions that were pro-Atambayev and then anti-Atambayev. And then Birbal, which was an opposition party that ran in the elections, for instance, and Ata McKen has some seats in there too, and they were an opposition party that ran in elections. So except for the Kyrgyzstan party and possibly some members of Atajurt, because remember that Respublika and Atajurt ran in as a one party in the last elections and won seats. But only those two parties would be, I would think, would favor someone like Japarov. You know, the other ones are all pretty much, well, Oynugu Progress didn't participate, so I don't know where they stand on this. They're most of their deputies that are in parliament have found other parties to join to run in the elections. But as it stands right now, in theory, most of these parties should be against someone like Japarov, I would think. Now who they're going to decide on for a prime minister, maybe someone like Babanov, but I think, you know, anyone that they put in there that's been a previous prime minister or someone like that really puts a lot of this at risk, because they're going to have enemies. If they're smart, they'd find somebody else who hadn't served as prime minister and maybe hadn't been in the government and put them in there. But, and then, of course, there's a question of whether they'll even get a quorum tomorrow when they meet.
Given that they already tried to come together twice, I guess. Okay, I think we are way over time. We need to end the conversation right here. But just one final question. But also, you know, I guess many of what we are talking about today or we discussed today will be outdated by the time this podcast will be on air. But let's see. We will keep an eye on what's happening in Kyrgyzstan. The final thoughts from you, Dr. Eugene, perhaps. So how do you see Kyrgyzstan coming out of this crisis? In what form, in what shape, and the likely scenarios going forward?
Well, you know, one of the major issues is what happens to the institution of the president. Mm. Does it continue to kind of muddle along as it has over the last 10 years since the formation of the new constitution? Or do you move in the direction which some people want of pure presidentialism or parliamentarism? And as my understanding, and others can correct me, that Zapata, and certainly others, Tashiev and a whole number of others, would prefer to move to a presidential system, a pure presidential system. I worry that in this 2 or so months of this interim period before the next election, that somebody may try to push this through. For my money, the ideal solution would be for Jeenbekov to back away, remain as president, become a kind of figurehead of the sort that you have in many parliamentary systems, most parliamentary systems, where he's the guardian of the constitution of sorts, but the prime minister becomes the real power figure and mobilizing figure politically in the country. This would, of course, require ultimately some changes to the constitution that would remove the power block, secret police and the Ministry of Internal Affairs and so forth, from the president's portfolio. But it seems to me we're at an interesting point where those kinds of fundamental institutional questions are going to be grappled with.
Whoever is going to end up being prime minister, given the current political developments in Kyrgyzstan, it looks like that person will be a kind of divisive figure because will be supported by one camp and the other camp is opposed. Any person pointed.
Well, could I say that if you look at this comparatively, in this kind of situation, it would be ideal to have a technocratic prime minister, to have someone come in from the outside without party affiliation or overt political affiliation, who is a technocrat.
Dr. Saniyev, I mean, you are the constitutional person here. Is there any discussion taking place in that direction, like bringing someone neutral into this position, at least for time being, until the election is held?
There were some, I think Klara Soronkolova was proposing. However, the majority of the opposition parties actually haven't supported this idea. And in terms of what can happen, I think having another yet constitutional reform even after the election is a completely not a good idea. Like, the biggest problem is that the Kyrgyzstan all these years were trapped by the bad governance and became victim of this constant turmoil, which led to the fact that our constitution is not stable at all. And it's kind of this vicious circle. And yet another constitutional referendum might lead to another turmoil after a while. So it's better probably for the what we can expect from the parliament is that certain checkbox, like important amendments into existing laws rather than changing the constitution, especially the laws on the elections and etc. Because if we start the constitutional reform, and I'm afraid that we might come back to the presidential form, because as it was already mentioned, Sadr Japarov Mekinchil, they fully supports the move towards presidential form. Yeah. I think in their even program, they mentioned about the bringing back the death penalty, all those issues. So it's just not the good time again to have the constitutional reform. Pragmatically, it would be better just to change it by through the law, like electoral law and etc.
But you know, if in case we are talking about a possible interim government, right? I mean, does the interim government even has the authority to make any changes like that?
No, then the like in 2010, what they did, they have constituted a constitutional assembly or council. They prepare the text and then it goes through the referendum. But I don't think that now the interim government scenario will come back, because as we can see, president is already coming out and imposing the decrees, and then the parliament is actually tomorrow meeting. So I don't think that the interim government in the scenario of 2010 will be here.
Okay, very final question then. Each of you can respond to this very briefly. So it is highly confusing what's happening in Kyrgyzstan these days, and we never know what will tomorrow bring. So where our eyes should be going forward in the couple of coming days to determine where the country is headed? I mean, where you will be looking at? Let's start with Asel.
Definitely, we should look at tomorrow's parliamentary session, because right now they say that tomorrow morning they will discuss two things, is their introduction of the emergency, and second is their consideration of Sadr Japarov for the prime minister, which in itself is surreal. after today's clash on the main square between Sadyrov's people and Babanov and Atambayev's people, and Japarov using the criminals and the old sportsmen against the peaceful protesters, that the parliament still considers him as a legitimate and legal candidate for prime minister is just really telling about where the parliament is standing currently. Mm. And it's standing on the side of Japarov and on the side of the organized crime. And I do not expect that the parliament tomorrow will be able to formulate an independent position from Jeenbekov, from the president. And that's a sad thing and can also lead to the escalation of the the situation. So I will closely watch that.
The upcoming parliamentary meeting tomorrow. Okay, so what about Dr. Husky, where your eyes will be going forward in the upcoming couple of days to determine where things are headed in Kyrgyzstan, for the better or for worse? I mean, where your eyes will be?
Asel is certainly right. The parliament is the key institution, in part because the president has been so inactive and almost disengaged. That's slightly overstated again, but the only other institution that's functioning, even though it's functioning poorly, is the parliament. As Bruce said earlier, a key question will be whether or not there's actually a quorum there.
Yeah.
If one was to look further afield, you might look at the courts and see if the Supreme Court or Constitutional Court had any other decisions, and look at how the state of emergency is actually being enforced, and continue to keep an eye on the South to see whether or not there is any reaction from there. We haven't seen terribly serious reaction so far.
Okay, great. Okay, Sonia, where your eyes will be?
It's definitely going to be tomorrow if the parliament is going to resume their work. How they're going, like, procedurally form the government? Are they going to follow the rules, because the coalition needs to nominate the candidate for the prime minister, and then the prime minister should present their programs and etc., and then they approve it? So it's, again, because it's important now, all those days what the parliament has been doing is everything was like behind closed doors with all these gross violations. And if they continue doing that, of course, it can be yet another reason for the escalation. And there is this, again, huge question of to what extent the imposition of the state of emergency was also legal or not. This also I should be watching closely. And on the reaction of the opposition as well. Are they planning to use it, this situation, to mobilize their forces or not? This is definitely one of my biggest concerns and fears.
Okay. Bruce, finally yours.
Yeah, well, you know, obviously I'm going to agree that tomorrow's parliamentary session, if it happens, is really the big deal. And we'll see what reaction they get to any of the decisions that are made there. You know, but I suppose more immediately, I'm just curious to see how we get through the night. The last I saw, things seem to be pretty calm in Bishkek. And you know, they have people were taking footage and posting it of different streets, and it looked like it was pretty empty and deserted. So let's hope they get through, they have one quiet night tonight, and maybe that'll calm some tensions, even going into the session of parliament.
Okay. Thank you. With this, unfortunately, we have to conclude the conversation right here. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. And big thanks goes to Dr. Asel Dolut-Keldiba, Associate Research Fellow at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek, Dr. Sania Toktogazeva, the constitutional law expert, also based in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, Dr. Eugene Husky, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the Stetson University, a long-time Kyrgyzstan watcher. Thank you very much for your time in Tots today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.